You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Science is interesting, and if you don't agree, you can fuck off.
Kia ora, Alan. How are you doing today?
Hi, Shamina. I'm thoroughly sick of this weather.
I know.
And I would like to then tell everybody out there in Radio Land about this wonderful new song that I just picked up out on YouTube, and it's called Will It Ever Stop Raining? And it's by a guy called Dave Kouse. So go and YouTube that because it's a wonderful, really, really, really good song.
And very relevant to our current context.
And another music thing I'm going to slip in before you ask me questions.
Go for it.
Is that Glen Campbell died today?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Saw that in the news.
That's tragic.
To be honest, I don't know a ton about him, but there was some sadness happening in the newsroom this morning.
Yeah, and as there should be. There's a documentary that he did on Netflix probably about 3 or 4 years ago. He had Alzheimer's, and he was doing his last sort of national tour of the US, and it basically documented his struggle with Alzheimer's, and he sort of had to call off the tour halfway through because he just couldn't do it anymore. It was really, really sad stuff.
That is really sad.
But wonderful, wonderful, great musician, and Wichita lineman and Galveston, two great songs. So, very sad.
Mm.
Yeah.
Moving on to a hopefully less sad story. I'm trying to figure out how I can segue that
to an average
job. But we've got how bees have been found to be the first insects to understand the concept of zero.
Yes. So there are some sort of strange stuff that we come up with, I guess, week after week. This would be one of the stranger ones, and you wonder what would motivate a researcher to find out whether bees could understand zero or not. But here we are, and they've shown that this is the case. So apparently there are some animals out there, chimps and monkeys, that can be trained to sort of understand the concept of zero. And so bees are now the first insects that have been shown to be able to do this. Now, apparently bees can count to four. I don't know how they know that, but apparently they can. So
just four, not five.
Yeah. So the way that they did this was that they would set up these two platforms, and one of the platforms, well, both of the platforms have got a number of different shapes on it, somewhere between one and four. And so they'd put one shape on one platform and maybe three on another one. And then they would train the bees so that if they went to the platform that had the smaller number of objects, they would get a nice sweet treat. If they went to the one with the larger, then they would get some nasty tasting thing. And so they trained them up like this, and eventually they got to the point where they got about 80% of the bees picking the one with the smaller number straight away. And then what they did was, again, same two platforms. Now they didn't put anything on one of them, and they had between one and four on the other platform. And again, they found that the bees would, after they'd been trained, more often than not, they'd go for the one that had no shapes on it at all. And then the clincher. So that was sort of showing that they understood the fact that there was nothing there, and that must be a smaller number than whatever was on the other one, and so therefore they're going to get the sweet treat. That's sort of the reasoning. And the clincher then was that they would do the same sort of thing, except that they would put now between one and six shapes on the other platform, zero on the one platform, one and six on the other one. Again, they'd found that the bees would go for the one that had nothing on it more often than not, but they found that when they adjusted the number, so the bees could very easily differentiate between 0 and 6, and they'd go very, very quickly for the one with 0, but when it was a choice between 0 and 1, for example, they would spend a lot more time trying to figure out which one to go to. So, again, they've sort of interpreted this as the bees thinking, or that they're having trouble differentiating between very small differences in numbers, and they could finally figure out that, yep, 0 is less than 1, and so therefore they go for that one there. So, bee psychology, I guess.
That's really interesting.
Yeah, it is. It is kind of cool. Yeah.
Is it just down to counting though, or is it like, are there other factors that can come into this?
Well, indeed. So, this actually hasn't been published yet. It's just been presented at a conference in Portugal. So it's by a group at RMIT in Melbourne, and so apparently the news reports of this are sort of let's not say inaccurate, but they're not complete. So they're not reporting completely on what happened. And so people online have been sort of saying, well, what about this? What about that? What about maybe the shapes? You know, do they have an influence or something, their particular shapes? And the actual author of the study has appeared on one of the message boards saying, look, please, you know, don't take this as gospel yet because we haven't published it yet. Wait and see the full version in the peer-reviewed journal. So it's pending, I guess, but certainly, you know, those are the results. Bees can understand zero. So, and you'll get to read all of the details, I guess, when that comes out.
Do we know why, I don't know, what... In a way, what? Why do bees have this ability, or would it help them do anything as a bee? Can you? I mean, maybe you're like, I have no idea.
Yeah. Okay. Join the club on that one. Yeah. Difficult question, Shamina. Yes. Yes. I think.
Will it help
like
them
a bee
pollinate things easier?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Or maybe they're just inherently intelligent. Who knows?
I feel like you could train anything to do that, though. Well, like any animal, in a sense.
Well, there's a research project for you. put in a Marsden grant. Come on. Hundreds of thousands of dollars. There you go. But no, I think that you're possibly not wrong in that.
It just seems interesting that it was... What I was thinking, I thought you were going to come up with something like they tested between... They did one thing with six objects on it and one with two, and they could, like, tell the difference... But I feel like comparing it with objects and then no objects, like you're differentiating between objects and no objects and not the number of objects.
Well, but there's the reason that they're going to the zero one is that they know that that must somehow be a smaller number than the one. That's the whole, the clincher of the thing, if you see what I'm saying.
Yeah.
So having been trained to go to the ones with the smallest number of objects, they immediately go for the zero. And that's, you know... That's pretty good proof, I'd say. In my book.
They can tell the difference between objects, low amount of objects, and then no objects.
Yes,
they know that it's minimum.
That's the thing, yes. Yeah. It's not the fact that it hasn't got any objects on it per se. It's the fact that that number of objects on it is a smaller number than one. So there goes the understanding of the concept of zero. That's what I think anyway. So
Really interesting.
Yeah, it is.
Still... Kind
You're
of
mulling it over, I can see.
Trying to get my head around it totally. But yes, so I'm just going to move on before I ask some dumb questions. So we've got the second story is spooky fingerprints of antimatter have been observed for the first time. So what is antimatter, firstly?
That's a really good question. Have you got a spare afternoon, I think, would be... I know we're in a hurry. Okay, so we have to make this
my
brief. I'm in a hurry too.
My eyes just darted to the clock there.
Okay, so we have matter, of which the universe is made up, and matter is made up of atoms, and atoms are made up of protons and neutrons and electrons, and that's the way that we understand things. And so in the Big Bang, way back whenever, what should have happened in the Big Bang is that equal amounts of matter and its mirror image counterpart antimatter should have been made. And if that was the case, then the entire universe would have automatically annihilated itself and it would just be full of radiation now, okay? So for some reason it doesn't, and there's more matter than antimatter in the universe. Now, what is this antimatter? Antimatter, as I say, it's the mirror image of matter. So in an atom, we've got positively charged protons and we've got negatively charged electrons. And the nucleus is made up of these positively charged protons, and around that live the electrons and they're negatively charged. So antimatter... We've got a negatively charged nucleus made up of antiprotons, and we've got positively charged electrons, otherwise called positrons, which are sitting in the place that the electrons normally sit. And as soon as this antimatter comes into contact with any matter whatsoever, then it instantly just annihilates. Okay, it gets destroyed and ends up with radiation. And this, funnily enough, you might think it's fairly esoteric, but it's the basis of a PET scan. If you've ever heard of a PET scan, positron emission tomography. And the way that that works is that you inject a radioactive nucleus into the body that localizes in the particular organ you want to image. And what then happens, it undergoes radioactive decay by emitting a positron, okay, which is a positively charged electron. Mm-hmm. And when that positron hits an electron and any of the matter around it, then bam, they self-destruct, and you end up with radiation gamma rays, which you can image in a camera, okay? So what they've managed to do now at CERN, which is the European Nuclear Agency, is to make atoms of antihydrogen, okay, which is a difficult enough thing to do in itself, but sort of fairly routine-ish now. But what they've then managed to do is to be able...
So that's hydrogen with positively charged electrons in the nucleus with negatively charged protons in around the nucleus.
100%. There you go. Full marks.
Thank
A plus.
You. Thank
that's,
you.
That's exactly right. Okay. So they've made this antihydrogen, and they've managed to have it sit around for about as long as 1,000 seconds. And so you can imagine that if this comes in contact with any matter at all, it's just going to destroy itself.
Mm.
So they have to keep it in these extraordinarily high vacuum situations, okay? So it can't touch the walls of the vacuum or anything like that, otherwise it's gone. So they managed to suspend it using magnetic fields and very, 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 very high vacuums. And then it sits around long enough that they can basically shoot microwaves at it, and that they can see the reaction of these hydrogen atoms to microwaves. And long story short, the nucleus has got a thing called a spin, and the electrons have got a thing called a spin, or the positrons have got a spin, and the antiprotons have got a spin. And it's the way that those things interact with each other you can see using microwaves. Now, this has been known for forever for good old bog standard hydrogen. And what they've gone and shown now is that you get exactly the same behavior with antihydrogen, so that it truly is essentially a mirror image of the hydrogen atom. So that's sort of antimatter in a nutshell. It's bizarre. And the big question in physics is, where is all the antimatter gone? Where is it? Because there should be lots out there. And why wasn't equal amounts, or why weren't equal amounts of matter and antimatter seemingly created in the Big Bang? So I guess if you could answer that question, you're probably onto a Nobel Prize in physics, would be my guess. So, yeah.
It's why is the headline fingerprints?
Fingerprints, because what they're doing is obtaining what we call spectra. So it's essentially the way in which atoms interact with radiation. And the way that we can figure out what the structure of atoms is basically due to the way in which they interact with radiation. And the radiation can be visible radiation, so visible light. We can see the absorption or emission of visible light. That could be microwaves, that could be x-rays. We've got all of these different sorts of things. And each of those has its own particular fingerprint, as you would, as they say in the article anyway, which is totally diagnostic, completely diagnostic for each individual type of atom. So there's 118 atoms on the periodic table. Each one of them responds differently to visible light or to x-rays or to microwaves or whatever, and that is their little signature or their fingerprint or whatever, and then you can tell the identity of any atom that you want. Okay, so it's really sort of an analytical tool to confirm that those are the particular atoms that we're looking at.
And so just we'll boost through our last story, which
we will.
It's very curious.
It's a puff piece.
Japanese scientists have made unmeltable ice cream.
Not totally unmeltable, but certainly stuff that doesn't melt. It doesn't melt at 28 degrees in Kanazawa in Japan. That seems to be the...
Because I feel like, how do you eat it if it doesn't melt?
Indeed. I think what they're trying to say is that it melts at a higher temperature than So when you've got it in your hand and it's a nice hot day, so there's nothing worse. It's the worst thing is you get ice cream all over your hand. You get all sticky. It goes everywhere. It's all over your face. And you know how it goes. So, and this was discovered purely by chance, and it all had to do with the tsunami and the earthquake in 2011 in Japan, which I'm sure you all remember, that horrific event. And the strawberry farmers in Japan were particularly heavily, heavily affected. That's the word. Yes. Impact is not a verb, folks. They were particularly heavily affected by this, and so when they got their strawberries growing again, they didn't look very good, didn't have that nice sort of look that strawberries have. And so what then happened was that they are all used as a source for extraction of a thing called a polyphenol, and polyphenols are particular types of molecules. They're present in wines, for example. In red wine, they've got these particular health benefits, etc., antioxidants and all that stuff. And so they're extracting these polyphenols from these dud strawberries, which were then given to sort of confectionery companies to use in confectionery. And then one day the people got a ring from a baker who had gone and put this into his whipped cream. The whipped cream suddenly just went solid and the guy wanted his money back, apparently. And then obviously an astute scientist thought, we could be onto something here. And so they then looked at this polyphenol, and they found that what it did was to basically make the fat and the water in, for example, ice cream or any sort of cream, it made them sort of stick together better. And so that what that does is to raise the melting point. And so therefore, you've got yourself now, if you go and put this in ice cream, you've got yourself an ice cream that's not going to melt at the normal temperature. It's going to melt at a higher temperature. So apparently they're quite happy with this over in Japan in the middle of summer. They think it's a great invention. The strawberry farmers are certainly onto it anyway. It's been a great thing for them.
Good old strawberry farmers. We used to have a strawberry farmer on the news team, R.A.P. Michael.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay. Not R.A.P.
No, like... I don't mean that in a literal way.
Oh, thank goodness. Okay, because no, we've had enough of that today.
No.
And, so that's basically the story of unmeltable ice cream. So, you know, it could be a big foreign hit. Remains to be seen, you know. Summer in New Zealand, are they going to export this stuff? Will somebody use it here?
Ben and Jerry's might get, you know.
Goodness knows, we've got enough strawberry farmers around the place here. So if you're looking for something to do with your strawberries, there's a possibility.
Awesome. Well, thanks again, Alan.
Not a problem, Shmina.
We'll talk to you again next week.
Okay, see you guys.
That was Dear Science.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.